Friends, you are listening to the Flannelly Show live, Irish Radio Network, USA, irishradio.com. I'm delighted to welcome somebody who's not just a friend, a personal friend since the day he came to the town. And he is Neil O'Dowd, publisher of Irish Voice newspaper, Irish American magazine, Irish Central website, and a columnist for newspapers in Ireland and spokesperson on TV and radio. Neil O'Dowd, extensively involved in negotiations leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. And very timely indeed that we should have Neil on. This is the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement coming up. First of all, you're very welcome, Neil.
Edwin, thank you very much. I was just going through my mental notes here. It's 34 years since I first came on your show. And I haven't changed a bit, but you've got a lot older.
I know. And I'm getting ready to cash in on it.
I just want to remind you that in that time, Mayo has still not won the All-Ireland.
Well, nothing like getting off to a good start. Okay.
I just want you to know that. And that my bet with Frank Durkin, your uncle, was that Ireland would be united before Mayo won the All-Ireland. I'm looking pretty good.
All right, well, you might have to get your money out this year, but then we've said that before. Neil, you have in your book on Lincoln and the Irish, and we'll get to that. But I do want to back up to the Good Friday Agreement. And it is, it's encouraging and it's good that former President Bill Clinton and, of course, George Mitchell, Senator George Mitchell, will be returning to Belfast for the official commemoration of the Good Friday Agreement. But perhaps not as well known as it should be is the lead-up to the Good Friday Agreement. And your, intense involvement during that period, and not only myself, but many of your friends were saying, maybe, just maybe, you should stay out of it. After all, there was much criticism in Ireland for a long time with those who would prefer to have Northern Ireland stay where it was and not drag their problems down to the south. Shamefully, many would say, but that's the reality of the matter. But talk about, if you will, before there was even mention of a Good Friday Agreement, how you became involved in the initial stages.
Well, I think, Adrian, one of the key things that we tend to forget is that George Mitchell arrives on the scene actually in 1996. And the reason George Mitchell got there was because the Irish-American community created the opening for the American involvement. And I was very proud and happy to be one of those people, but there was a large group of people, also including yourself, who became involved politically in the whole issue of why was Irish America not able to make a difference in Northern Ireland. And I think that became a fundamental question coming up to the 1992 presidential election. And a group of us, and your Uncle Paul particularly, was one of the key people who decided that it was time that Irish America took a stand and created the opportunity to bring America into the Irish peace process. And we were all very fortunate in that our first meeting was with the candidate for the Democratic Party, Bill Clinton, and that he made certain promises to the Irish American community during that campaign that became, to my mind, the whole basis of the peace process that would never have succeeded without the involvement of those Irish Americans. And like yourself, I do feel that story is not told enough. And I think that the people who got Bill Clinton involved were the people who got George Mitchell involved, were the people who made the change, the profound change that we know in Northern Ireland, the most successful peace process probably of the last half century, one that has still continued today, even though there are problems. There will always be problems. But I can tell you this, Adrian, you and I would often sit in the studio on a Saturday morning and hear the news from Ireland and hear about the latest killings and bombings and murders and mayhem that was going on in our country. And we don't hear that anymore. Sure, we hear a lot of arguments about what the Irish language means and issues like that, but that's politics and nobody's been killed. Yeah. So I think Irish America has not really been given the credit for the role. People like Bill Flynn, people like Chuck Feeney, people like all the Irish American groups who became involved, the Irish American Unity Conference, the AOH, all of whom made it possible for the Bill Clinton appointment of George Mitchell that made all the difference in the Good Friday Agreement.
You know, you had mentioned there in giving credit where credit is due, those meetings and also following through on the notion that coming up to a presidential election in the United States, the time to get the attention of the candidates was not after the election, but previous to that.
Right.
And my co-host for many decades, John Deary, was very instrumental, you know, in setting up those first meetings.
In fact, John, I ran into him, would you believe it, the other day, for the first time in many years. He was at the St. Patrick's event where Gerry Adams basically handed over power or leadership of Sinn Féin to Mary Lou MacDonald, and there was about 400 Irish Americans at the Sheraton Hotel, and John was there. But I mean, John's forums were a critical part of all that, and it was just a number of different people working and finally coming together with a cohesive plan. And the plan really was twofold. One was get a visa for Gerry Adams, which became a huge international story when it happened in February 1994. And the other was to create a peace envoy. Those were the two conditions and two claims and two efforts that Irish America pledged to make. And it's a great credit to them that we succeeded in doing that, because without that, we wouldn't be talking about peace in Northern Ireland. It's as simple as that.
But, you know, Neil, and my guest is Neil O'Dowd, on a flashback to those days when, yes, we would sit in the studio with guests and talk about and listen to the news of the troubles in Ireland, there was another aspect to that as well, in that many listeners and readers and those who were in Ireland were looking at Irish America and many of the supporters from Irish America who were actually contributing to the progression of what was happening. There was the notion that Irish America, and I, you know, we can refer to NORAID and several other organizations,
right.
They weren't looking particularly Irish in Southern Ireland, which, like I say, didn't want any part of it anyway. They were looking and saying, "Who needs Irish America? They're adding fuel to the fire here, and to some, that's all they expected. That was it." And therefore was, you know, a lot of people felt, why don't you just stay out of our business? And of course,
well, I think the credit for an awful lot of the change in the Irish Republic belongs to one man, and that was Albert Reynolds. When Albert Reynolds became Taoiseach, he made it very clear, and most people didn't believe him at the time because politics was so much, politicians were being so much criticised for doing nothing in Northern Ireland, but he came into power, no record or history really on the North, and said, I'm going to approach this as a businessman, I'm going to be pragmatic, it's going to be my priority, it's the issue that counts most when you go around the world, people talking about the violence in Ireland, and he said, I'm going to be the man who tries to bring peace. And everyone thought at the time in the South that, oh, he's, you know, talking off his head.
Yeah.
But in fact, Albert Reynolds made the breakthrough in terms of the idea of the envoy, the idea of the of the special visa for Gerry Adams, they were all ideas that he ran with. And without him behind them, they would never have happened. And, of course, there was also John Hume, who Reynolds convinced to come in on the side of a visa for Adams. So it showed the power of one man and one man's thought that basically the Irish Republic, which you're absolutely right, had this attitude that Irish America would interfere and make things worse rather than better.
Yeah.
Albert Reynolds came in and proved the exact opposite, that by working with people over here, by working with the likes of your program, Bill Flynn and Chuck Feeney, myself and AOH and people like that, that you could bring pressure to bear on the British to do something, that by internationalizing the situation, by not keeping it in their own little box, that change could come about. And it did profoundly. And I often think that Albert never gets enough credit for that.
Yeah, and, you know, you can add to that that here was a Taoiseach, a Prime Minister of Ireland, who was not from Dublin. He was from down the country. He was from Longford. And
you don't want to be from Longford.
Well, I don't know.
Certain people I know from Longford.
Well, definitely if we win the All-Ireland, we win. Not it, when we... But you know, Neil, we have mentioned, and many have mentioned, the influence of the Chuck Feeneys, the Bill Flynns, Bruce Morrison, and several others. But in fairness, they came in at your urging after you had done a lot of the groundwork. And I don't know whether you're at liberty to talk about you as a Lone Ranger in the North sitting down to discuss a ceasefire with the IRA. And
well, I think, Adrian, it goes back to the original battle that you and I fought, which was immigration reform,
mm-hmm.
and the Morrison and the Donnelly visas, in which your program played such a huge role. From our point of view, we proved something back then, that Irish Americans, when they came together, could really make things happen. And we remember the desperation and the despair that people had at the time that they couldn't get legal. And instead of moaning and complaining about the issue, we actually went out and we lobbied, and we came across people like Bruce Morrison, and we came across people like Bill Flynn, Dennis Kelleher, people who were ready to, Chuck Feeney, who were ready to help us. And then I saw that as an indication that if we could do it on immigration, which was a very tough lift, and we did it with Morrison and Donnelly visas. Unfortunately, they sunsetted those particular visas, which is something that I look back on with a lot of regret now. But using that as a springboard, I thought to myself, well, why don't we try the same approach in Northern Ireland? Because we knew one thing, that nothing was going to happen in Ireland unless something from outside changed. And that thing that outside that changed was the American government becoming involved. And the way to get the American government involved was to start at the very top, which is what we did with President Clinton. So I was very proud that there were so many great Irish Americans who joined that effort at the time. And we spread the word far and wide. There was a time when nobody thought that Northern Ireland was anything but an insolvable problem, and people used to actually admire the problem rather than try and solve it and say how mm-hmm. difficult it was. But I loved the American attitude, which was, I knew if we could get Clinton involved and that was the key, then the whole thing would change dramatically, because the British would despise the fact that it was suddenly an international issue. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, there was an article in the Washington Post from March 8th in Washington Post magazine this year outlining that whole scenario of how I was involved and how other people got involved in creating the opportunity for what ultimately became the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah, we will remember, though, that after Bill Clinton became president, people like my Uncle Paul, people in the community like the Frank Durkins, yourself, the AOH, and a great number of people were restless with respect. The aforementioned and a lot more figured that the minute he took his jacket off in the White House, the first issue would be to, address Northern Ireland and follow through on what he had promised. So at a time when a lot of people were getting hot under the collar, You developed a personal relationship with Clinton, and lest anybody think it was your good looks, which you don't have any.
Thank you very much.
It was your barrel of ink. You know, Irish American magazine had taken off, Irish Voice newspaper had taken off, and you were, you know, a columnist in Ireland. It didn't do any harm for the White House to look and say, this upstart is not going to go away, and that was the beginning, and let's acknowledge that. Is that at a time when, you know, we are great friends of Ireland and Congress and, you know, at the Senate level, but somebody had to get through, and that had to do with Gerry Adams, unless we just, you know, fluff over the significance of Gerry Adams. Can you just give us, a brief encounter and a brief description of how that came about in the first place?
Well, I think that my own view was always that from about the mid-80s, Sinn Féin were looking at some way of going down a political path rather than a military path. It was obvious to people who were on the spot that the war was going to be at best a stalemate, that no side was going to win, that there was going to be atrocities, there was going to be deaths, there was going to be people killed. Everybody would keep what we called the whataboutery, what about that massacre and what about this massacre. And soon as the IRA committed an atrocity, the British Army would follow up with one of their own. So it was actually going nowhere. And I think Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness were clever enough. And I also think just the generational thing, Adrian, that they were getting to the stage where their kids were getting older and they were having grandkids and they were wondering, well, is this the future forever? So it all kind of came together. Also, you have to view at the same time the South African peace process was proving very successful. So there was a sense of a time and a tide. And I got to know Adams quite well. I gave him a column in the Irish Voice. At the time, it was forbidden for him to speak publicly in Ireland, as you know, on television or radio.
Just on that point alone, I think a lot of our listeners and the diaspora throughout the world would say, excuse me, what do you mean?
That's a very good point to call me on, because when you think of it now, they paid a guy to imitate Gerry Adams' voice on television, and Gerry said the toughest thing he had to do was tell that guy he was unemployed when he finally got to use his own voice on TV.
But he could not voice his opinion.
Literally voice himself, yeah, you're right.
You know, he was... You know, he was banished.
He couldn't say good morning on RTE. He couldn't say, you know, how are you, Adrian? How's the show? I mean, it was all banned. That was the stupidity of it, that you could somehow stop a movement just by silencing the leader. But I think, you know, Gerry was a very astute guy. He understood that things had to change, that the IRA were not going to win the war, and neither were the British. And that at some point an attempt at peace had to be made. And I think he looked to America, and I think I was fortunate that I knew him and advised him that with the right president, I really felt very strongly that something could be done. And I think that happened when Clinton was elected, and we went back to Clinton with the clear provision that we had asked for a visa. We had supported him during the election, the Irish Americans for Clinton group. And we found a president who actually, to our great surprise, was very knowledgeable about Ireland, even though he was governor of Arkansas. But he had been a student in Oxford University in the late 60s when the Troubles broke out, and he understood fully what was going on, which was a real bonus for us.
Neil, can you tell us about your role? Now Gerry Adams has his visa. There were a great number of Americans who couldn't determine the difference between the Sinn Féin party and the IRA. And obviously, throughout the world, I'm sure with the help of Mother England, to define and to accept that, in fact, Gerry Adams, regardless of his background, and that the whole movement of Sinn Féin, you know, couldn't be. Here you are now. Here we are. The Gerry Adams that can't open his mouth on, you know, on radio or be seen on television in Ireland has now inroads into not only America, but through the White House into publications like yours with the column and so forth. That must have sent shivers, you know, up the back of a great number of people, particularly in Northern Ireland, who had, you know, the desire and perhaps the long-range view of, you know, what eventually wound up to be an assembly, unfortunately one that is at the moment in limbo. But just, you know, zero in on that part for us. And what brought you to Northern Ireland to sit down and not be, you know, locked up in speaking with the IRA at the time?
I think the key thing, Adrian, was everybody, a lot of people drew the line at talking to the IRA and saying that should never be done. And to my mind, that was complete stupidity. You had a war going on. You were having all these settlement efforts that were ignoring the fact that the war was being conducted by people who were feeling that they had been very badly mistreated. And yet, you weren't offering them any opportunity to get out of that war, to sit at the table. And my view was always that if you could bring Sinn Féin into the process, as long as Northern Ireland was Britain's dirty little secret and wasn't on the world stage and there was an acceptable level of violence, nothing was ever going to happen in the North. But the minute that Sinn Féin became respectable, so to speak, and Gerry Adams was able to come to America and he got a visa and they started winning elections, it suddenly became a transforming moment because the British realized, well, we can't keep this secret anymore. We're going to have to deal with this issue now because the whole world is watching. And I think that was the key thing that Irish America did more than anything, Adrian, was bring to the forefront the fact that Sinn Féin had a position that was not all about blood and guts and shooting people, but it was much more about the consequences of partition. What had happened to Northern Ireland was infinitely explainable in that 600,000 Catholics were put into a state they had no allegiance to. There had never been a Catholic in government bar one person who was a token Catholic in 50 years. There had been massive discrimination. There had even not been one man, one vote for a period of time. All these facts came out, and once the violence disappeared and the fact that people could look at this dispassionately and say, yeah, you know what, we have to do something about this. But the main reason why they had to do something about it was because, in my opinion, people like Albert Reynolds and Irish-American leaders finally stood up and said enough. Because, Adrian, you know as well as I do, the years you've been in America, we're defined by two issues. We were defined by the troubles in the North, and we were also defined by the issue of immigration, because our community, as we see nowadays, is suffering because we don't have immigration, and a lot of the institutions that were great in the Irish community, like the county associations, the GAA, are suffering very badly. Well, that has always been a big story, and so has the North, and I always felt that both of them had to be addressed because they defined us as a community.
How did Northern Ireland, America, Southern Ireland, how did they distinguish or how did they perceive the Sinn Féin Party versus the IRA and the Troubles?
Well, this is the thing. People, you know, basically, there's a lot of people who jumped into the peace process, Adrian, and you'll be familiar with this, after the fact, once the IRA ceasefire had come into effect. Suddenly it was safe for people to get involved. But before that, you know, there was a very clear belief, certainly at the highest levels in the Dublin government and the British government, that Sinn Féin and the IRA could be permanently isolated and nothing would ever happen, and that we'd all keep this very much under our hat and not talk about it too much. Mm-hmm. I always remember a British Northern Ireland secretary, I can't remember the man's name, talking about, quote-unquote, the terrorist community, that the people in West Belfast were basically terrorists, not just the IRA, but the people who lived there. So, you know, there was a long and tough road to climb. there was a lot of people who felt it was unsolvable. There was a lot of books written about how incredibly difficult it was. But actually, when it came down to it, when you made a direct appeal to people on a human level and you said, look, we can help you get out of this, as we said to Sinn Féin and to the parties in Northern Ireland, look, America's here to help. We have finally have a president who cares. I thought the response was very generous on the other side, and people did reach out and say, yeah, you know, maybe we can make a new go. And I think that's where peace came from. It was from the American intervention fundamentally.
When you met with, and I, you seem to be ducking this one and you're not getting off the hook. When you met with, you know, with the leadership of the active IRA who weren't all that thrilled with Sinn Féin in the first place.
Sure.
These are the people who, you know, who, like my late cousin Frank Durkin said, the only justice the Brits ever understood came out of the barrel of a gun. You had to convince the hardliners, the boys, as they would have been known, that if there was not a ceasefire, that the possibility of getting Irish America, never mind Clinton, but that Irish America would not come on board, that you could not gather as you did the Bill Flynns, the you know, the powerful Irish Americans would not be part of an influential group if there couldn't, if there was not a ceasefire. And again, you were involved in those negotiations, and you know, did you approach them? Did somebody approach you and say, listen, we better have a sit down?
Well, you make a very good point. I mean, I did approach them, yes, and I said to them that I felt that Irish America was changing, that it was about more than Norway, that there was a lot of other people of the caliber of Bill Flynn and Chuck Feeney and Bruce Morrison who would want to help. But we needed to see a sign that they were serious about making peace and not just continuing the war. And in September 1992, we went to Northern Ireland. And I'm sorry, right after the election of President Clinton, we went to Northern Ireland and we said to them, here's your chance. You can either take it or leave it. We believe that if you give us an indication, which in this case was a 7-day ceasefire that the White House would know about, we will get people involved and we will, we believe, have a very good opportunity to break the international isolation of Sinn Féin and get Gerry Adams into America. That was the basic plan, and that was the basic plan that worked, Adrian, that we said to them, show us your good faith. Do a 7-day ceasefire while our delegation is in Ireland. And they did that in September 1993. And that was the beginning of the outreach between the White House and Sinn Féin. From then on, I was acting as an intermediary between Sinn Féin and the White House.
Yeah. And coming into my program with Malachy McCourt, Jesus.
Yeah, I saw his last book where he's rising out of the coffin.
Out of the coffin. But, okay, so it comes to what is known as the Good Friday Agreement. And
right.
One that both of us happened to be in Ireland at that time for the rollout of it. You know, many people would have gone home figuring this is one more try. They're not going to come out with an agreement, you know. And George Mitchell, Senator George Mitchell, had done his level best, and even he was ready to throw his hands up. Talk, if you will, about your buddy in the White House at the time. You know, President Clinton picking up the phone in the middle of the night. Did that have, was that the deal breaker? How would you describe that influence, that particular part?
Well, I think it's a very interesting aspect to this that has not been really covered much, which is that the key guy in the Good Friday Agreement ultimately was not George Mitchell or Gerry Adams or John Hume. It was David Trimble. For the unionists to cross over, it took the bravery of a unionist leader to say, yes, I want to do this. Now, I don't have a very high opinion of David Trimble most of the time, but I have to say that on that time, during that time, he showed a tremendous amount of bravery in deciding to bring his party in behind the Good Friday Agreement. And the reason he did so, in large part, which doesn't get written about much, was that President Clinton gave him certain assurances at the time that things that he was worried about would happen or would not happen, in as the case may be. And I think a tremendous amount of the work that President Clinton did at that time was to help with the loyalist community and the unionist community. And you remember, Adrian, from the great days in the White House, it was Bill Clinton's insistence that the unionists feel part of the occasion too. That was very, very important in swinging their opinion behind what ultimately became the Good Friday Agreement. So I think if you were to look at Bill Clinton's contribution during the Good Friday Agreement, I think one of the most important ones was persuading, on the night before he signed up to it, where Clinton was up until 6 a.m. in the morning, persuading David Trimble to take this chance. And David Trimble took that chance, and history has been written ever since because of that moment.
There we go back again 20 years, and you spoke about the courage and conviction of you know, David Trimble. If you want to fast forward to today, where Arlene Foster, you know, who appears every now and again to be ready to cut a deal to get the assembly up and running one more time, she said, I can't do this because I go back to, you know, the to my people and they say, you're crazy. Why doesn't it work today, considering that the peace process has been in effect for 20 years? Nobody wants to go back. Is it, you know, without getting personal, so let me get personal, what is it about Arlene Foster that cannot do what David Trimble did at that time with the same degree, you know, of aggravation and division between, you know, the unionists and nationalists in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question because clearly she's lacking in confidence. She doesn't believe she can bring her party with her. I go back to a comment that President Clinton once made to me, which was that if Gerry Adams had been where Yasser Arafat was, we would have had peace in the Middle East because Gerry Adams was able to bring his leadership with him. Arafat was not. And it's the same reality with this woman because, unfortunately, Arlene Foster is unable to bring her party with her. She would have splits and divisions in her party. Now, why that is so important, I don't know, because there is really no opposition on the unionist side to her party. I mean, the old Ulster Unionist Party of David Trimble is effectively dead in the water. So I think that she could do it, but she's still very much trying to find a way to do it without disturbing a couple of the right-wingers in her party. I think in the end she has to go with it and lose those right-wingers, which is what Adams had to do, which is what Trimble had to do. If you remember Geoffrey Donaldson walking out today, the agreement. You can't bring your whole party with you. It's just not possible. And she needs to face that reality and say, well, she has enough support to do a deal. They came very close the last time, and just go ahead and do it. And yeah, you lose some people, but guess what? They're not going anywhere anyway.
Do you, are you among those who believe that Arlene is in rather shaky position herself with the unionists in Northern Ireland, and maybe she doesn't want to push her luck?
I don't think there's anything like the militant aspect that was there years ago, Adrian. You know, you look at the vote on Brexit, where more people voted to, you know, oppose Brexit than support it. A lot of Protestants voted to stay with nationalists on that one. I mean, I don't think the same atmosphere prevails at all. 20 years of peace, you know, it's not a great peace, it's not a perfect peace, but it just means that people are not as naked in their aggression and their ambition. And I think Arlene Foster, in a normal political discourse, in a normal political reality would accept the fact that she can't bring 100% of her party with her, go with the 90% or so she can, and do the deal and get back into government. But what really complicates things, Adrian, is the fact that the DUP are not getting any pressure from the British, because the DUP are propping up the Tory government in power. The nine or ten seats that they have are the difference between the Tories being in power.
Neil, I want to, on this day, not ignore the significance of the horrific immigration policy of the United States, and for the great number of people who feel that perhaps because of the new Taoiseach Leo Varadkar's visit to the White House and the backslapping with President and Leo, the Taoiseach, that the wink and the nod is in one more time, sending up false hopes to a lot of people here who do not need any more aggravation, who do not need any more tension than they already have. Just give us a read on what you think will or may be expected to come out of that St. Patrick's Day meeting with the Taoiseach and President Trump.
Well, you know, you're right. There was this atmosphere, and every Prime Minister, every Taoiseach who comes on St. Patrick's Day wants to give an upbeat account of the hopes for the undocumented and the hopes for future immigration. But I'll be very honest, Adrian, I can't think of a time in the 34 years you and I have been talking that I felt more negatively about immigration reform. And that's been just totally blunt, because this president is kept in power by a hardline group, particularly within his own White House, Stephen Miller in particular, who's writing immigration policy that not only is threatening illegal immigration, but also threatening the numbers of people who can come here legally, where he wants to cut it by 50%. So you're in a defensive mode. It's a long road. It's a very difficult road. But I honestly, with my hand on my heart, can't see anything happening with Donald Trump. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But I honestly, like you, I looked at what happened on St. Patrick's Day. My immediate thought, to be honest, was something like that was much better kept quiet rather than publicized.
Absolutely. Particularly since, again, without getting into American politics here, one would hope that the newly elected Taoiseach, Prime Minister Barlow, wouldn't go home and say, listen, between yourself and myself, there's going to be another, visa allotment. We're going to loosen things up, and trust me, this is going to be a good deal, while totally ignoring those who have had a very productive life here. And whether that number is 50,000 or more or less really doesn't make that much difference. But
right.
but it is unfair to be in a position just again before the bowl of shamrock is put into the bin down there to do that, or to even suggest in the frivolity of the St. Patrick's season to say, okay, I think we got it this time. That's not fair, number one.
No. It's funny. About 3 weeks before the Taoiseach arrived, the foreign minister was down in Washington and asked for a special envoy for Northern Ireland, a request that was granted.
Yep.
3 weeks later, the Taoiseach arrives in Washington and says, oh, we don't need a special envoy. That gives you an indication of the confusion and the lack of cohesion within the government on the issues that affect Irish Americans. And to me, Leo Varadkar sort of turning down a special envoy is a huge mistake, because back to our earlier point, how do we move the unions to last time it was through America? And the same thing could happen this time. But immigration has become, it so much should have been solved 20, 30 years ago. It's like school shootings. People should have taken it under their wing in the 80s when it became a problem to begin with and sorted it out once and for all. But it's just got worse every year since, Adrian, and now I think it's the worst I've ever seen it. I mean, I go back to times when we were very close with Kennedy McCain, and even George Bush had an immigration bill, and there was goodwill on the Republican side and goodwill on the Democratic side. That's all now disappeared, unfortunately. And the only way, I understand what the government is trying to do, but I don't think they should have gone public with it. I think they should have done it very quietly if they were able to achieve it, because now everyone else knows about this particular plan and probably has a way of trying to stop it because it doesn't help their community.
I heard you have a book coming out.
I have a book. It's called Mayo Windy All-Ireland 2099.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, well, okay. So then this is the end of the interview. So long. Have a good day. So God bless you. All right. On the worst, in the worst snowstorm a couple of weeks back in New York City, you had the cheek, downright cheek, to launch your book, your latest book, Lincoln and the Irish, at a party in Fitzpatrick Hotel. Rumor has it that you conned New York Times columnist, your good friend Maureen Maureen Dowd, to you put her up for the night before, and because you knew this thing, and she couldn't get out. And then you had so many people who were scheduled for the launch of your book, who were stuck in ditches. Some of them have still left the car there after them. But it, the book itself, Lincoln and the Irish, and your Maureen Dowd, your good friend, you know, she introduced the book how I would like to introduce it as well, taking poetic license here. And you say you could pick a book on any individual whatsoever, but crossing the line to pick a book on and an individual who is the second most written about person in history, second only to Jesus Christ, is again, it is something that only you. maybe Malachy McCourt, except he's
Malachy, but he was Malachy remembers Lincoln. He was around when Lincoln was around.
That's they grew up together.
That's right.
Lincoln, having Lincoln and his relationship with the Irish, I think, if you wouldn't mind, you brought to mind, and you rattle the history books, to recount that 125,000 Irish fought for the North, and of course there were 25,000 for the South.
Right.
Lincoln was no fan of the Irish, and so how did that...
Well, he didn't start out as a fan of the Irish, but, you know, it's one of the great unwritten stories in Irish history, Adrian, Irish-American history. It's just how much, and they've never got the credit for it, the Irish made a difference. If you consider Lincoln had 500,000 soldiers or 600,000 soldiers any one time, 125 to 150,000 of them were Irish. This was a time in the Civil War when 20,000 Irish a month were arriving into New York and Boston. And they were coming off the boats and they were signing up for the Union Army. And Lincoln's own life, you know, nobody ever talked about the Irish links, but in fact, I'd always been fascinated by them because, for instance, growing up, when he lived in Springfield, Illinois, all the nannies of his children were from Ireland, and he learned an awful lot of the Irish tunes and songs. He could recite Emmett's Speech from the Dock. He could recite a lot of Irish poetry. One of his nannies was so good with his wife, who was a bit of a headcase, that he paid her extra money every week to stay when she wanted to go back to Ireland. So right from the beginning, he was involved in an Irish group. And then if you watch him politically, his biggest opponent was a guy called James Shields, who's one of the great unwritten stories of Irish America, a guy from Tyrone who came to America penniless, found out that the uncle he was supposed to come to had died while he was coming over, joined the U.S. Army, became a very well-known general in the U.S. Army, then moved to Springfield, Illinois to start a political career, and ended up as the direct opponent of Lincoln to the point where they almost fought a duel. They actually arrived at a field in Missouri to fight a duel because they had fallen out so badly. But later, Shields went ahead and supported Lincoln in the Civil War and is the only Union commander who defeated Stonewall Jackson in the battle. I'll just give you that as a kind of background that we know about the Fighting 69, we know about the incredible Irish history around the Civil War, but we don't actually know about Lincoln the person and the Irish. And what this book does is talks about, for instance, in the White House, there were all Irish people who walked around him. The guy who was the doorman was a guy called Ed McManus from Mayo, who served 6 American presidents. The people in the White House complained that Lincoln was hiring far too many Irish because he got on so well with them. And so it just goes on, this kind of trend, which has never really been written about, which I thought was very interesting, but culminating, Adrian, in an amazing incident at the most important battle in American history, the Battle of Gettysburg, where if the South had broken through, we would now be looking at 2 different states, a slave state in the South, and probably a military dictatorship in the North, because Lincoln would have been would have been replaced. At the Battle of Gettysburg, on the third day of the battle, when the crucial moment arrived, when the Pickett's charge, 13,000 troops marched across that field to try and break through the Union ranks, the very first group they met was the 69th Pennsylvania, not the 69th New York, the 69th Pennsylvania. And the 69th Pennsylvania were all Irish-born immigrants, run by headed by a guy called John O'Neill from County Derry. And they stood the ground. 2 regiments beside them deserted on the spot because the onflow of 13,000 soldiers was so threatening to them. And they were the ones who held up the picket charge long enough for reinforcements to arrive. So in many ways, you know, they saved Gettysburg, they saved the Battle of Gettysburg, and they were given credit by a number of historians for doing it. But somehow we never learnt that history. And what's very important for me, Adrian, is that we talk a lot about the Irish who fought in the First World War. But if you were from Mayo or Cork or Kerry or Tipperary or anywhere on the West Coast, you emigrated to America and you fought for the Union in the war. And yet if you go to Ireland, there's not a single monument or a mention of them year after year. 35,000 of them died defending Lincoln, opposing slavery. And I just thought it was time to tell their story.
Yeah, well, it was also a time... perhaps to straighten out, you know, references, brief references to what was the fact that the Republican Party, you know, were aligned with the anti-Catholic, know-nothing
yes.
party.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, that must have been, you know, helped to some degree in terms of, you know, of separating Lincoln from that mentality with the support of the New York Archbishop, John Hughes.
John Hughes, absolutely, and Thomas Francis Meagher, and General.
How much did that actually, in hindsight, now we know the significance and the power of the Catholic Church, but did Lincoln, again, was that an opportunist, you know, an opportune moment to see if he could get an endorsement that would separate the feeling that that's what the Republican Party was about anyway?
Yeah, you know, you make a very interesting point. The Republican Party was the party that was anti-slavery, but it was also anti-Irish. It's a hard thing to kind of figure out. But the Know-Nothings, who were the racist Ku Klux Klan at the time, they opposed the Irish. They were all brought under the wing of the Republican Party at one time, at the old Whig Party, actually. But Lincoln made it clear in a very famous speech that he was not a Know-Nothing, that he did not believe that Irish people or Catholics should be driven out of America. And I think a lot of Irish, particularly Cardinal Hughes or Archbishop Hughes, Thomas Francis Meagher and General Michael Corcoran, they were the 3 leaders in the Irish-American community in New York. And they all said that they felt the Irish should fight for Lincoln, which was an incredible thing for them to say, but they did it for two reasons. One, because they wanted the Irish to be considered American, most importantly. They wanted their, because the Know-Nothings were trying to make them seem like they were aliens and outsiders, the fact that the Irish were fighting for the Union Army was a hugely important thing for them. And secondly, Adrian, they thought that there would be an opportunity to fight the British after the war. And in fact, they did, as you know, try and invade Canada.
Right.
They figured they would get great military training. These 130,000 people would get great military training to take on the British. It was all a kind of a grand plan that Maher thought up. But, I mean, in fact, in the end of the day, they were fighting for Lincoln. They were fighting for the Union. They were fighting for Ireland. They were fighting to defeat slavery. And we know so little about them, whereas we know everything about the soldiers who died for Britain in the First World War,
yeah,
or whatever. We know very little about these men.
And in fact, you know, Neil O'Dowd, you know, we could say that in many history books, it just, you know, it underlines without mentioning the North. Here were the 25,000 Irish fighting for the South without even knowing what the hell they were doing, other than getting a payday out of it, couldn't care less. It's time to straighten that out as well.
It is. You know, the Irish in the South were not slave owners. They were poor people who got off the boat in Charleston and ports like that and joined up with the army. I'm not going to excuse them, because there were definitely some, like John Mitchell, who was a great Irish patriot at one stage of his life, became a very, very prominent supporter of slavery. There were Irish Americans who supported slavery. I don't think we can deny that. But I think the vast majority of the Irish born were looking for work and looking for some way of making, you know, getting by when they landed in these southern ports. But I think
were there a part of that, though, and historians would say, well, you know, they didn't know the difference. I'm not sure. That would hold water. You know, they came off, and as many immigrants before them, they needed a job. And
that's right.
Again, I don't want to be an apologist, but a lot.
Well, so there's a very interesting priest called Father Bannon, who was originally from Dublin, who was a pastor in the Confederate Army, a very famous pastor who actually was very brave in the field of battle, went out and fought beside his men. But he was sent to Ireland on a mission by Jefferson Davis towards the end of the war to try and stop the Irish coming out to America, because Jefferson Davis knew that the Irish were making the difference, because ultimately the Civil War was won by the army with the bigger numbers. In other words, the army that could afford to lose more people in battles. And unfortunately, a lot of those people were Irish. But his job was to go back to Ireland and convince the archbishops to not allow any more Irish or warn Irish against coming to America, that they would just be signed up for the Union Army and would get killed. So you can see that the importance of the Irish was actually much greater than what has anything that I have found that has been written about them. And in most cases, like Ken Burns' Civil War series, they aren't even mentioned, which is incredible if you think about it.
Okay, the book, again, is Lincoln and the Irish, and it has really taken off. And I suppose the best way to get it is on www.amazon.com, on Amazon.com.
Yeah, it's also in Barnes & Noble.
And it is in Barnes & Noble?
In fact, I was just on Fifth Avenue yesterday looking at it, putting the copies in much more prominent positions.
That's good. It's also on, it's hardcover, but it's also on Kindle.
Yeah, in fact, you know, it's incredible, Adrian. I look at the sales numbers and 75% of it is on Kindle now. It's so easy, you know, from your own house or whatever, just to download a book.
Yeah.
It's incredible how everything has changed so much since the old days for you and I.
Yeah, and also,
remember, you know, the days when you arrived in with a mobile phone, it was about the size of a brick. We were all looking at it saying, what the hell is this thing?
That's right. How about trying to, you know, to make a call from the middle of a bog down in Mayo with with Charlie Haughey, launching the O'Dwyer Forestry Foundation. You know, and my uncle said, "What is that joke?" You know.
I know. I remember.
He said, "Wait a minute! You're in the middle of a bug, and you're on, and you're on to my office in New York. Give me that thing."
I know. It's incredible. You look at some of the old movies now, and they have these things that probably weigh 5 pounds.
Neil, again, I thank you for joining us.
We thank you. It's been a real pleasure, isn't it, to go back. Remember the old days. They were great days. They really were.
Great days. And again...
I have such fond memories of heading to Tommy Makem's after your show.
How about the number of guests who were supposed to return to Ireland on the flight, and then when you when you see Tommy coming in?
I remember one particular night when we went in about 2 o'clock in the morning, in the afternoon after the show. And when I emerged from the pub, it was still daylight, except it was the following morning.
I'm glad I went home early. I didn't. I wasn't right.
I don't think you did, actually.
Thank you, Neil O'Dowd.
Thank you.
The book is Lincoln and the Irish. It's in Barnes & Noble, and, of course, you can get it on Amazon.com. Neil O'Dowd, again, somebody I'm proud to know as a friend. And friends...